Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Daisha Eaton of KSKA, and Dermot Cole of the Alaska Dispatch. The Sullivan administration's labor law revision will be on the November state ballot. Finally, the question, the voters will have the opportunity to address this question after much maneuvering by all the parties involved in the fight over union employment and union work rules and wages. Daisha, you have been following this issue. What finally happened?
The Assembly decided to set the date for the public to vote on the referendum for November, basically separating it from the time that regular elections are held. A lot of people were hoping it would happen in April. Of course, Mayor Sullivan vetoed that idea a long time ago. Some people were arguing that the charter says that a vote has to be held within 75 days of the most recent court decision around this referendum, which of course is AO 37, or the Responsible Labor Act. And the Assembly didn't buy that. They went ahead and set the date for November. Some people say that
on
this is
totally split vote, a split decision.
Totally split vote, split along the same lines that kind of the referendum has been split, or that the labor issue has been split on up to this time. And so we'll see. Now it's going to be on the state ballot in November, and you know, the administration says, "Oh, this is good because more people will turn out to vote." And the people who are, of course, against AO 37 and support the repeal of this labor law say it separates it from municipal issues and it's going to get lost amongst the state issues.
Steve, this is complicated. And you sort of have to wonder if this is has the potential to turn out differently than the advocates of putting it in November suggest. For one thing, there's a possibility that Mayor Sullivan himself will be on the ballot as a candidate for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and it's really pretty funny, in a way. This is, again, I've said it before on the show, I'll say it again, that this is going to be the most intriguing and bizarre election season in the history of the state. So many things are intertwined and interconnected, and you don't, you wonder if this, as Daisha said, AO 37 might wind up being a referendum on Dan Sullivan. People are going to love it.
People
or hate
who might
it.
Not vote for Sean Parnell if he's the Republican candidate because they're mad at Sullivan.
That's true. That's true too. That's another thing. And of course he's got skin in the game in another contest in August. He, of course, Governor Parnell has the tax issue that's up for possible repeal.
The oil tax.
The oil tax. Yeah. That's correct. So I don't think I've ever seen an issue that's gone before the Assembly that has been kicked around like this political football has been. I don't think I've seen this
and
much
kicked to court several times.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, it has gone a full gamut, and it's almost as if, you know, I don't like the way the game's being played, so we're going to change the rules, and that's kind of what happens here.
In the spirit of the Super Bowl, we have the courts playing the role of under further review.
Boy, and that's, yeah, we have to just see how this is all going to play out. It's intriguing. I hesitate to even offer a prediction of what's going to happen, but because it's Alaska politics and it's nearly impossible to predict those things. So, but yeah, it is this is a city issue that should be on a city ballot in a city election. Instead, we're going to take this one issue and we're going to move it down the line into November, and it'll be a city ballot, city election amongst all this U.S. Senate, state legislative,
governor's
race, all of that stuff. So like Daisha says, does it get lost in all of that?
Okay, let's try something a little different.
Certainly.
Steve, the Richardson Highway avalanche that dumped tons of snow across the roadway that connects Valdez to the rest of Alaska is still there. It's maybe the biggest avalanche that any of us have seen.
I think so.
Provide the details.
Well, it is. It's a huge avalanche. We had a crew down there covering this thing for the past week or so, and they said it is just massive. It took them a minute to fly over it in a helicopter.
I think they said 1,500 feet, if I might.
About that, right? That's about right. And about 40, 50 feet high. That's how high up it goes. It's just massive. It's actually a couple of avalanches, from what I understand as well. And yes, it's gone all over the Richardson Highway. And then for added effect, it kind of blocked the Low River, L-O-W-E, Low River, and created a lake. So they had to really worry about that and the water that created, the high water that created. So Department of Transportation crews really had their hands full to try and start working on this thing. The water finally receded. The river is back pretty much within its normal confines, and they've opened up more of the highway now. When it's going to be completely open, not sure. A lot of it still depends on the weather, and I'm sure they'll make some good progress on it again today.
If I might, I'm told, and reporters would know this for certain, that there just isn't snow in the avalanche. There are trees,
right,
brush, boulders, dirt. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah. Well, if you drive down the Seward Highway and look up at some of these avalanche chutes, you see that there's kind of void of all vegetation. These things come down and they take out just about everything in their path. So this was so big, it was rocks and ice and heavy snow. Heavy snow traveling down a mountainside, and it just takes out whatever is in its path. It's one good thing is that it didn't hit that bridge. It came close to the bridge, but if it had hit the bridge, who knows what kind of structural damage that could have caused that. So we could have been looking at a gigantic repair bill, but I think that thing's going to leave scars for many, many years to come. But
it'll become when it clears, the area will become a tourist attraction.
Yeah. But the people in Valdez are a hearty bunch, the 4,000 folks who live there, and they're doing just fine, it sounds like.
Thank you. Dermot, HARP may be history. The high-frequency active oral research program, certainly a bigger mouthful than HARP, may close after years of controversy and speculation. Remind us, what is HARP and why did it generate so much speculation and controversy, and what's its future?
Well, this began as a Ted Stevens earmark in the 1990s. And over the years, the government has spent close to $300 million on HARP. It's an ionospheric research project. Conspiracy theorists say it causes all sorts of things, from earthquakes to tsunamis and hurricanes. So it is a cultural phenomenon, in a sense, that everybody believes it's responsible for anything that goes wrong anywhere in the world. For scientists, it's sort of a complicated story. The Air Force says it wants to stop maintaining the site, and it wants to either transfer it or shut it down. In other words, it will shut it down if it can't find another agency to maintain the site, which is off the Richardson Highway near Gakona. The dilemma is, how are they going to find maintenance money to continue to operate the system when it's no longer strictly a military project? There has been military research there, and that's probably gave rise to many of the conspiracy theories, which still exist and are still, current on the internet today.
Books have been written in the conspiracy theory vein, right?
Many of them have been written, Mike, and it's a complicated project. The way it works is very complicated, but there's several million dollars of maintenance money that has to be provided for somewhere. And anyway, the Air Force says it's looking to shut it down this year, perhaps as early as this year, if it cannot find an arrangement for someone else to take it over. Now, in that light, the White House is hosting what's being called a HARP summit in this month, to bring together all sorts of people in science to see if anybody's going to step forward to take it over.
Now, is this decision, or this decision that's in process, the result of a policy decision about HARP, or is this part of a fiscal retrenchment, or both?
I think it's largely a financial issue. Ted Stevens was the real godfather of HARP, and he kept putting money in it every year. The mainstream back and forth of the U.S. science community was not directly involved in it. It was just a deal that Ted Stevens made with the military and with some universities. But at this point, the Air Force is saying it's got to cut its budget, and this is something that it thinks it can do without.
Okay. Steve, big headlines. Shell Oil cancels its 2014 Arctic drilling season. Some viewers and listeners may have anticipated this cancellation given the problems that Shell was have, but now it's official.
Yeah, for folks who want to see development of the Arctic, this is a bitter blow. The state of Alaska, certainly down in Juneau, there were a lot of people who were pretty upset about the decision and downright sad about it. But Royal Dutch Shell made the announcement on Thursday that it won't be drilling in the Arctic this year. They cited two reasons. The first one was they lost about $10 billion, they had a very poor fourth quarter, and to make up for the lost revenues, they're going to cut $10 billion out of its capital budgets for the 2014 year. The other reason it cited is uncertainty. The federal government, with the federal government here in the U.S., Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out of San Francisco, I think it was last week, ruled that the federal government failed to conduct a proper environmental impact statement before letting out the leases for the Arctic Ocean. And so basically it's instructing the government to go back and do that. Shell basically says, you know, there's so much uncertainty here with that ruling. We're not sure what we're going to do yet. Governor Parnell in Juneau yesterday told us that he wants to see Shell file an appeal and take this to a higher court, probably the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think actually they could get this was a panel of the Ninth Circuit.
So yeah, three judge.
Yeah, they could get the whole,
yeah,
get the whole court to.
Yeah.
So they might.
Yeah, but so I think Shell is actually considering that. They're considering their legal options right now at this particular point in time. But a lot of somber faces, a lot of sour moods, a lot of the predictable. This is nothing more than federal overreach that was coming out of Juneau. Federal government overreaching its authority, blaming the court for this. So, the hope is now that Shell will come back again in 2015. The company has laid out $6 billion for this particular project, and it's a lot of money to walk away from.
That is for sure. Dacia, the Big Timber Motel here in Anchorage may be closing, and this could be real bad news for residents of modest income who live there.
Yeah, a lot of news organizations have covered this story very well, and I was one of the reporters who got to go down there and talk with these people who are basically using the motel as low-income housing. And you'll see this a lot in Anchorage from downtown to Mountain View, kind of in that corridor by Merrill Field. There's a lot of this. There were fire code violations in the building. It was infested with bed bugs and mice. Lots of other problems. I went in and visited some elderly folks who are living there and families. I even held a two-week-old baby who was living in there. And so far the municipality, what happened was the guy, the owner, Terry Stallman, it's been in the papers, didn't pay his taxes. The municipality took the building over and they have poured $40,000 into it. Today they let that information out, paying up his back bills for gas and, also doing other upgrades, so that people can have hot water and heat.
And if we might, the Stallman himself is living there, sleeping on a couch in there, right?
That's what the story in the paper said. I can't confirm that.
You did not see him sleeping on the couch.
I didn't see him when I was there, but there were reports in the Anchorage Daily News that he had been staying in the office there. So it's a bad situation. The municipality is not collecting rent from them. They're trying to figure out whether they're going to demolish the place or sell it or what they're going to do with it. But this is not the only place there's problems. This is happening all over town. I visited the Mush Inn.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a little
bit. And some other places. So, it's cockroaches, bed bugs, leaking ceilings, and people are really desperate for housing.
And this is kind of a classic. If one person had a problem, Terry Stallman was living there by himself, it would be his problem. But when you have a group of people, what are they going to do with these people? Just put them on the tent or the street in the wintertime?
I guess a ray of hope in all of this, though, too, is the city's been getting some offers from nonprofit groups and other business people saying, well, we'll step up, we'll pay the back taxes. They'll have to reimburse the city for the work, the $40,000 that it's invested in the building already. But perhaps there's a buyer out there.
I've also heard that businesses surrounding the motel are interested in buying that property and demolishing it. And they have to give Mr. Stallman the opportunity to pay his back taxes, mm-hmm, as well as pay for the upgrades if he wants to get it back. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, Governor Sean Parnell's plan for a gas line from the North Slope to Tidewater attracts supporters and critics as the legislature opens for business. Steve, elaborate. Where's the discussion as we see it right now, well, or hear it right now?
Yeah, right now we're starting to hear more and more details about the state taking an ownership stake in a natural gas pipeline. This is going to cost a lot of money. We're talking about a $40 to $60 billion project, I believe, it's estimated by state leaders that it could be a $9 to $11 billion investment by the state, depending on how big of a stake it wants to purchase, 20% or 25%, or if they have a partner in on this as well, price could possibly go down. The Parnell administration says this is a good, solid plan. It gives the state a seat at the table and a say in what happens with the project and planning the project. Critics are saying, Senator Bill Welikowski, for instance, he said, okay, this may be a good plan, but we should be studying other options. We shouldn't just be focusing on this. We need to bring in all kinds of different ideas into this. Parnell administration pretty much says, no, this is the plan. We want to proceed with that. Bill Walker, who is a candidate for governor, an opponent of Governor Parnell's this fall, he feels that that the agreement is pretty much one-sided in favor of the oil companies and gives oil companies an opportunity to just say, no, we don't like the tax structure, veto the whole deal and the plan scuttled. So we'll see how it all plays out as it's starting to get out more and more in front of the state legislature.
Dermot, you've followed this issue for a long time. Give us your perspective as it develops now.
Well, as somebody said the other day, the pipeline's getting closer than ever.
Given that this debate has gone on 35 years.
Yes, yeah. This, in some ways, is very similar. I know the administration doesn't like to present it this way, but it is very similar to the Murkowski plan from 7-8 years ago. There are some big differences, however. The biggest one is the idea that this TransCanada would step in for the state and in the gas treatment portion of the project and the pipeline, TransCanada would actually pay the state's share of construction costs. That's the main way by which the state hopes to keep its costs down. And then TransCanada would earn a rate of return on its equity and the state would eventually pay it back. It's very complicated to explain this. I don't know that legislators are really going to get to the bottom of it. I think the big problem so far is that the administration has not explained it in clear, simple language. It is complicated, but there are ways to make it clear exactly what's being proposed. The state does take great risks with this approach. There's also potentially big rewards, with the biggest one being this might be the way to actually entice the oil companies to build a pipeline, because this would lower their risks if the state does.
Bill Walker came to the Anchorage Daily News editorial board yesterday, and the board had a chance to meet him, and I had a chance to ask a few questions, and he really is of the opinion that the impediments to the pipeline have been presented as economic, that the gas wasn't economical. And we've heard this over many, many years. But he believes the impediments are really political, and they reside with the oil companies, who essentially their key to the gas line is they want guarantees about oil and gas policy and us to change the Constitution about how we go about taxing. What do you make of this argument?
There is a strong element of truth in what he is saying. Part of this current plan would be for the state to not collect taxes, per se. Instead, the state would collect a certain amount of gas. The administration wants it to be 10.5% of the gas. So with that 10.5% and the 12.5% royalty, the state would get up to 20 to 25% of the project. Now, in making that agreement to collect the tax as gas, there could be opportunities there from the oil company's point of view to make this a tax freeze that would last for decades. The administration says it's not a tax freeze, but the way the oil companies have always said they want a tax freeze and they want fiscal certainty. And this appears to be the way through this plan under which it would be gained. The key thing here, Mike, though, is the administration has proposed legislation to set up a confidential negotiation process that would take place this year. And then contracts would actually come to the legislature in late 2015.
That's what I was going to ask Steve. I mean, part of this is it's going to play out over a number of years, correct?
Yes, that's
right. In fact, there's a sort of an assumption in here pretty openly that Parnell assumes he's going to be reelected to continue the process.
Well, that's true. And it's going to be hard to explain this, as Dermot said. It is very difficult to explain. It's difficult for the average Alaskan, the average reporter, to get your arms around this thing. How much of this is going to be behind, behind closed doors, where there's contract negotiations, things like that are going to go on. How much are we even going to be able to find out about this? You know, one of the things that was Joe Baelish of the Department of Natural Resources told legislators too. He said that there's a potential of the state earning, I think the figure was $130 billion over a 30-year period from all of this. So, people are going to probably zero in on that figure there, and that might be the thing that propels this forward. But again, the state also stands to lose quite a bit of money should this thing go south. It's a big risk.
This isn't going to be the end of this discussion.
No,
you're going to be on this show talking about it again.
Years from now.
Dermot, Medicaid and the emergency room. The state director of Medicaid says that more than 6,500 Alaskans use the emergency room as their primary caregiver when they have problems at big expense to the government. Give us the facts as you understand them and what is to be done.
Well, in a presentation to the legislature this week, the state Medicaid people made the case that something really needs to be done so that Medicaid clients do not automatically go to the emergency room for minor problems. They have a term for people who go to the emergency room over and over again, and they call them super utilizers. And they say that super utilizers are a big drain on the system, in that it's very costly to go to the emergency room if you just have a cold. So they are trying to see what structural changes can be made in the healthcare system so that these people would be directed into clinics. And those with only really serious injuries would go to the emergency room. I think there's also a public benefit there, clearly, because if the emergency room is clogged up with people with minor problems, that makes it more difficult for people with serious, with serious conditions. Many of the people that are in this condition, in this situation, the so-called super utilizers, there are many children, and there are also many adults with chronic conditions, and they just don't have a primary health care provider, and that's why they're just going to the emergency room.
Okay, Daisha talked about the Big Timber Motel, a mush-in motel.
Yes, I went around to a few other of these kind of budget hotels around Anchorage between downtown and Merrillfield, Mountain View area. One of them was the Mush Inn. I met a woman named Cassie Lee Lewis there. She's 48 years old. She took me right into her apartment, and we actually saw a bed bug, and she smashed it in front of me and flushed it down her sink. She showed me water leaking through her ceiling into her room that she's regularly collecting. She told me she kills dozens of cockroaches and bedbugs every day. Then I also went over to Henry House, which is a transitional living center. It's for people who come out of the mental health court and out of the jails. They take a lot of people that nobody will take. But once you get into those rooms, which women aren't allowed into, and I could not go into, but a resident actually took pictures and brought them out to me of his room. He didn't want to be identified, but he did show me those pictures, including a hole in the floor, a hole in the wall, and lots of other problems. He didn't see any pests in there. But he basically said, for people who are trying to make positive changes in their lives, this is a really bad environment for them to do that.
Yeah. And the municipality is going to have to address this. So we're going to have to leave it right there and come back to it. Dermot, for years, critics of the National Missile Defense System have argued that the system, part of which is based at Fort Greely, just won't work in the case of an attack on this country. What have you heard recently from the Defense Department and others?
Well, there's a report this week from the Pentagon that said the so-called kill vehicles, which these are the devices that are placed on top of the rockets at Fort Greely. It's calling into question the reliability, and what the term they used was how robust they are. There have been a series of test failures in the past 3 years with these kill vehicles. Now, the rockets are not launched from Fort Greely. The military doesn't do that because they worry about dropping rocket parts on populated parts of Alaska. But these tests do occur out over the Pacific, and there have been various problems with the kill vehicle. The director of testing and evaluation for the Pentagon is now saying that perhaps the kill vehicles need to be redesigned so that they are more reliable and more trustworthy.
And we can't be trustworthy any longer because we are out of time. I'll be gone next week and the week after that, but I'll be back in three weeks to see you right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.